10. 1, 2, 3.
Is it Arthur? That's what you
meant? Quick show.
Okay.
Well, and if it's very inexpensive, then it's all right. Would you rather ask it over
here?
That might be easier.
Yeah,
do that. No, I'll allow you to be missing.
Okay. I did go through the century of black surgeons, and I found it very interesting. Two articles you wrote did pertain to some of the material I'm interested in. Yeah.
And it would give you more than that, some background, especially the article on Charlie Drew.
Yeah. It
would give you some background on people.
Yeah. Well, and also the one on Tuskegee and his connections with the Spalding Division. I wasn't quite aware of all that. So.
Well, the one on Drew gives a little different perspective. And that was important to that.
I wanted to get to
it. Sure.
I was curious about the situation at Spalding when you came in 1958. Was there any training programs for black surgeons at Spalding at that time, prior to your coming?
There was no accredited training program, educational program, in what we call graduate medical education, not only in Spalding, but nowhere in the state of Georgia for black physicians, not in any specialty whatsoever. And that was the big emphasis by many individuals, because obviously specialization was here. It began, as you may recall, at the turn of the century with ophthalmology, which was the first medical group to set themselves aside as documented specialists. And then at about 1937, by following the efforts of people like Flexner in 1909, 1910, 1911, and the work of Halstead at Johns Hopkins in surgery, where he developed the residency program in surgical education, if you know it, the rest of the country sort of caught up, and it was decided that there should be methods for documenting that an individual had received adequate education, graduate education, and that specialty board should be organized, and individuals then would receive a prescribed amount of surgical experience and education, and documented as certified specialists in surgery. Mention surgery because that's my particular specialty. The principle holds for all of the various specialties and subspecialties in medicine. Let me just make one thing clear. I said graduate education. And mind you, in medicine, when an individual is in college, literary school, why, that, of course, is an undergraduate. Now, if he's seeking another degree, then that's postgraduate education. But in medicine, that individual in medical school becomes again an undergraduate. And graduate education, in our view, is that education after that person has received an MD degree and is proceeding along specialization lines as a resident. That's graduate education. Postgraduate education in medicine has to do with the individual who has completed all education as a specialist, perhaps certified by a board, and then who returns once or twice a year or whatever for the rest of his life while postgraduate.
New techniques and whatever.
That's right.
Now, when you, I think one of the stipulations you mentioned in the Tuskegee article was that there should be, you had a guarantee of a program being set up at Spalding before you came, I believe.
That's right. I made it clear to UC Spalding that there was no need for my coming here, or anybody else for that matter, to work accepting that there could be a and approved accredited program in general surgery asphalting in order to work with. Otherwise, one would be just spinning the wheels.
And they were agreeable to that?
Well, they not only were agreeable to it, but worked for it and got that accreditation.
At what point after you had arrived?
No, that was from the moment ago.
Oh, so from the right
in 1958, actually.
There was already a program? Yes.
No, there was no program here. There was nobody here.
Yeah.
But the agreement was here.
Okay.
In other words, we did that with letters between Hugh Spaulding and myself while I worked in Tuskegee.
Right. Okay, I saw some of those letters. Okay. What was the reaction at Grady to the change of the Spaulding? I mean, apparently, black surgeons, black doctors in general, could not treat patients at Grady.
That is correct.
Okay. What was their reaction to the changes at Spaulding from the person the training program?
All right. This was discussed with the chief of surgery, Dr. R.A. Ferguson,
senior.
He was very helpful in many ways, in every way. And so was Mr. Hugh Spaulding, senior. They were very frank and open. They agreed to the Spaulding resident and myself to come over and work in the clinics at Great, the outpatient clinic. That as we examined patients here and treated patients here, these were greater patients, we treated them on the staff, that the ones that we want to send to Spaulding for operation, we will do that.
Even if they were indigent patients?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Sure. We had 12 indigent beds for indigent patients. And in addition to that, I, of course, could admit private patients with them.
But for the bulk of the black patients at Grady, they were still not within your...
No, my surgery was done at Grady.
Yeah.
And I didn't intend to say that. That's Spaulding. My outpatient work, our outpatient work, the resident and my residents and myself was done at Grady. We used a Grady outpatient. In other words, Spaulding was the name of it was the Hugh Spaulding Pavilion of Grady Memorial Hospital. In other words, it was a ward of Grady Hospital. A ward which we used for the education of black residents under a segregated system which existed at the time. Nobody wanted the segregated system. I didn't want it. The residents didn't want it. Spaulding didn't want it. Nobody wanted it. But that was state law. Ferguson didn't want it either, as far as I knew, anyway.
Well, it seems as chief of surgery at Grady's, Ferguson could have, I guess, helped to change the system a little more than it did.
Well, he did have to change the system. Mm-hmm. And so did his successor, Dr. J.D. Martin. And so did some other people who have to change the system. But, that's the way we worked. We worked the outpatient clinics at Grady. We operated at Spaulding. We used the research facilities at Grady.
Okay.
And we used the library at Grady. Because those things were essential to an accredited program. And they all understood that I would not work in a program that was not accredited.
Now, what could you not do there?
We did not use the operating room at Grady.
And then you didn't make the rounds of the patients at Grady, did you?
These were outpatients. You can't round them.
Okay, right. I mean, I guess I meant the inpatients.
Yeah. Anyway. So that this is the way it worked. And that was the way it was pretty much all over the country. It was not the best way, but that was supported by federal law. Up to 1954. After 1954, the federal law was abolished by the Supreme Court. But between the mid-1890s, at the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, up to 1954, it was federal law. The second, it was just, which was an unjust law.
Absolutely. At what point did Grady open up its other inpatient facilities to Black Rifle? How did that come about?
That happened about 1965, 66.
Mainly for demonstration.
The impetus was, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. Right. So that really is the cause. And then, of course, this fellow came down from the federal government to meet the government, I forget his name, Page or something like that. And then, of course, with the demonstrations, students, doctors, everything.
I guess part of the Civil Rights Act of 64 was some provision dealing with federally supported hospitals in terms of the segregation practices. That must be changed.
Well, that was a part of it, too. And then, of course, if you want to go back into the history of it more, why, in the Veterans Administration, Truman began the breakup of the process. Truman began it. And he pointed out that it was.
So it really took, you came in 58. Mm-hmm. It took into the 1960s, you're saying, for Grady was opened up?
That's about right. I'm trying to recall the first year. It was right through there.
So really, Ferguson, although he was sympathetic to you and Spalding, and all those people really couldn't change that.
Well, what they were doing was acting in keeping with Georgia law and Georgia habit. Mm-hmm. Because the habit outlasted the law. That's what it was. But you asked a little bit ago, what was it like? Ferguson told me, as I was in the process of decided to come here, and after Spalding and I, we with an accredited program, he said, remember now, you can get killed working at Grady and going back and forth. And frankly, the basic idea that it was just right to have a program in Georgia which would provide specialized training, accredited, fully accredited, in the state, be it at Grady or Spalding or wherever. Until that was not a frightening thing. I really wasn't concerned about it. But I did mention to Dr. Ferguson, how can you expect us to work well in an educational program and do clinical research with that type of threat hanging over our heads? And he said, words to this effect, don't take the statement out of context of our total conversation. He says, it's only fair for me to let you know what could happen. He says, I don't think it will happen. But you ought to know and come to you what the situation could be. So we got a resident who agreed to work and came to work and carried on from there. And at varying times it was really interesting though. At times of informal conversation, you called in. Would say, you know, just go ahead and do the work. It won't be long before you'll be on the staff of Grady and him. Ferguson said the same thing at one time or another. Said, just go ahead on and do a good job. Frank Smith, Frank Wilson, the superintendent of Grady, who was viewed as an arts segregationist, told me the same thing. He said, come on, do a good job, move on, and it won't be too long before you will be on the staff in surgery at Grady and at him.
Well, they were probably supportive, waiting for, I guess, public opinion to change a little bit.
This seems to be about what it was about. Now, it took the work of many people, starting way back with Charlie Drew. I hope you saw the letter.
I did. I was in issue about it.
Okay. That Charlie Drew wrote, who firmly believed in much of what I'm telling you of God. Charlie Drew was, he just had it, as you probably noticed, he just had the purest heart of anybody I've ever seen. He was an unusual individual. He was a gentleman in the finest sense of the word. Whenever he entered the room and became a part of the discussion, he was a cynosure of the whole area. He was a charismatic person. Frankly, I just didn't like him. I always realized he deserved and earned the admiration of it. He felt that excellent work would transcend psychedelics. And of course, he knew nothing about the techniques of Martin Luther King that I knew nothing about. Now, he had read the works of Gandhi, I was not aware of, but he knew nothing. And this was his approach toward eradicating segregation, was by excellent performance. And even if he had known the works of Gandhi, still, one must have people who are willing to perform in keeping with the standards of that time in order to work in a university setting. You just can't simply do it. So that it takes many different types of people, it takes many different types of groups with different interests, different backgrounds, different ways of accomplishment in order to make a social change actually occur and become a permanent
change. Well, I noticed that what Eddie wrote in 47 seemed to coincide just about the same time the Urban League was dealing with some of its reports on health care for blacks in Atlanta. It still took a few years for Spalding Pavilion ever to materialize, but I sort of got the feeling that Drew was one of the inspirations for what became Spalding Pavilion.
Well, yes and no. He wasn't thinking so much of that. I think that the prime individual who worked culminated in the Spalding Pavilion was Mrs. Grace Towns Hamilton and Mr. Hugh Spalding Senior. Those were the main ones. And of course at that time you have to remember that the separate institution was popular throughout the nation. Nobody, we as black people didn't regard this as the ideal of what we wanted. We regarded it as the best we could do under the circumstances. Few or none of us were aware of the means of accomplishing anything using the techniques of Martin Luther King, Jr. and Gandhi. I did not know of the techniques of Gandhi until Martin Luther King had demonstrated a long time. And I didn't realize that he had gotten these techniques from Gandhi. The only thing I read as a student this country was the fact that Gandhi was fast, and I never knew it was Marsh. Hello.
Okay, let me just get up to a little different track here. I was curious about the effect of the lack of training programs and the segregated situation at Grady on, for example, healthcare for blacks in Atlanta. It's very clear that the black population here had a much higher death rate than the white population, but there were fewer hospital beds.
And this still is. And the death rate is still high.
Okay. Do you relate that all?
Black
at all?
Population.
Yeah. Is it a poor people's problem, or do you rate it all to the just lack of hospital beds and the segregated situation among the hospitals here?
Well, it's all that and more.
Okay.
it's obviously not the lack of a certain number of arithmetic beds, because the beds are here. It's the socioeconomic, and I know that's a cliche word, and the conditions under which people live. I don't believe that there's any genetic difference between black and white people that causes one group to live any longer or less long than another. I think it's the educational level. I think it's their habits. I think it's a matter of type of food consumed. And this is habit two. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of abuses or lack thereof. And both groups abuse. One may do it a little more than another. Things like that.
Do you feel at all that black patients in Grady, poor blacks who were in Grady, who couldn't be seen by their own doctors if their doctors happened to be black and were only attended by white doctors, do you think they were given less concern care at all by the whites? I mean, this is still, you know, getting back to the period where there was a lot of race-based state, obviously.
Let me give you a specific example of that. There was a locally well-known surgeon in New Orleans, and I'm trying to think of his name while I'm talking, who stated that black people withstood peritonitis less well than white. He was basing his opinion on the higher death rate from, let's say, acute appendicitis or perforated appendicitis, and the results that he got in black patients as compared with white patients. And this was one of the things that Dr. Drew attacked as he trained us in general surgery. And he developed a paper on it and tabulated the cases, mortality rate, morbidity rate of the patients operated with acute appendicitis and all the complications of appendicitis at Friedman's Hospital, which was then the teaching hospital at Howard University School of Medicine, and compared it with this surgeon in New Orleans. And he showed very clearly that with the care at Howard University, they, like people, did not have a copy of morbidity or mortality or anything else. What was the difference? And this has to be speculation. I don't have any documented truth for it. At one time or another, they all got operated. At one time or another, they all got what anti-infective drugs they were available at the time. The difference probably was in the time factor. It was in the time factor in these respects. The patient probably, feeling a little unwelcome, waited a little longer until the pain got worse, as long as they could bear it. So they probably came to the hospital a little later,
feeling unwelcome, I'm sorry,
feeling a little bit unwelcome. Probably reported to the hospital a little later than usual. They were not the next door neighbors and friends of the medical staff, and I never would be. Therefore, the staff responded a few minutes later. And that response probably would continue with the entire treatment. If a nurse called for the fellow who lived down the street, you know, and it shouldn't be a factor in medicine. I don't think it is, actually. But the response might be just a little bit later than if this guy was someone who had a little closer relationship. I think it was a time factor. But because the I think that in general, physicians do administer the very best care they know how to administer. So that I feel that it was popular.
Okay, my thinking, I guess, was given the racism so blatant at that time, that among the white doctors, there must have been those who were totally concerned with the health of that black patient.
Well, I'm using different words to say the same thing. If the fellow is eating lunch and the nurse calls and says such and such a thing is not right to feed his wife, he might just sit and finish his lunch and talk for a while.
That's where I think black doctors making the rounds of grading might have been. Might create a little different situation.
Yes, this is right. This is right. You can't take a human being and teach him that another human being is a second-rate human being and expect him to respond as rapidly as he's going to respond to a first-rate human being. I'm calling it time.
That's what I was thinking also. How about the segregated situation at Grady, the lack of training programs, and what effect that had on attracting black doctors to the office? Were there a short, I know there was a shortage of black doctors in the city. Was this related at all to?
Yes, that shortage related to many things. The lack of a teaching hospital, an academic hospital, and it's more interesting to work. But it related to more than that. It related to the small number of black people entering the field of medicine for multiplicity of reasons. The medical schools were segregated. There were some that took black students, there were some that did not.
Some that had quarters, I suppose.
I think right.
Some that had quarters on a number of the days were segregated.
Well, you know, I think the word quota was misused, and I don't want to get away from the prime question. They didn't have quotas, they had ceilings.
Okay, that probably isn't possible.
If they had quotas, it probably would have worked out a whole lot better.
And the ceiling might be one.
The ceiling might be one, and I think that's what the trouble was, the ceiling. Now, let's go back to the original question. The pool of black individuals who had completed college training, or at least pre-medical training, needed to be interviewed. And of course, the ability to enter a school of medicine at less cost, at less distance of travel, less expense to a poor family, which was the great majority of black people. All of these factors entered into the shortage of physicians. Now, for example, when I began in medical school, I had to go from here to Ann Arbor, University of Michigan. The travel expense was there, the tuition was higher. After my first year, I attempted to get into the University of Georgia, and they told me flat, no, you will not be accepted in the school of medicine. That was about 39 academic.
So I guess for most black doctors who did receive their training, either southern institution like Howard, let's say,
Howard or Mary,
or a few northern institutions like the University of Michigan, University of Illinois, I think particularly Harvard, occasionally, and others.
Well, again, what would be the attraction of that doctor to come to the city like Atlanta? Segregated hospitals?
It would be just a matter of a previous association with the city sometimes, or a feeling that it was a good place to practice because of the need, and a field for an economic situation that was helpful to rapidly develop a practice and to work. There was no stimulus insofar as continuing to grow medically and in medical scientific knowledge, nor the stimulus of teaching or the stimulus of an academic institution.
Or are you getting an association with a hospital or a social
service? Well, that's what I'm saying in different words. Because the academic stimulus would be in the hospital setting.
So really, I would guess the impetus to come to a segregated city like Atlanta would really be limited, which might explain somewhat.
It related to the economics, it related to previous contact. There was no academic stimulus.
Nor were that might be part of what you're saying, but nor was there any respect for the black doctor by the white doctor in the city. They weren't allowed to join the medical association.
That's right. They could not join the medical association, that is what was then called the county association, which was the basis for the American Medical Association. They could not join, in those days, the American College of Surgeons and all of the other colleges, physicians, pediatrics, etc. These things were barred. Let me just mention that Dr. Drew was not readily accepted into the American College of Surgeons. He, having been well qualified, they finally invited him to become a fellow for the American College of Surgeons. But they were doing that for him as an isolated individual and were not admitting the black surgeon on an individual basis as a group. And he refused to accept membership, since other well-qualified black surgeons were not being accepted. Mm-hmm. So that after he met this tragic accident while the American College of Surgeons gave him fellowship posthumously.
That's messed up.
That's the way the story went. Yeah. And I'll never forget the day that Drew told me that he had refused fellowship with the American College of Surgeons because he realized fully that it was solely extended to him as an individual.
When black doctors began working at Grady, actually being allowed into Grady, were there on the last couple of them?
No, not at all. I came over, made rounds, operated in the operating room, and as a matter of fact, they were very cooperative. And Dr. Ferguson handled it very well. He and I walked through the building, and he introduced me to key people such as the supervisor of the operating room, supervisor of the clinics, people on the wards, and he said, "This is Dr. XYZ. He will be working here." He'd extend him every courtesy, and we went through the key portions of the building like that and took care of it. Now, this was after the word page contract came down from HEW, and after the student marches, and after the physician.
This was in the 60s.
That's right. Okay. So I became a member of the Emory Clinic in 1968. That was through Dr. J.D. Martin, Jr., who invited me there. And then I became a full partner in 1970. I was an instructor in surgery prior to 1968, but the exact year escapes me at the moment. Probably the mid-60s. About 65 or 66, somewhere around.
What about
64?
Emory Medical School, what did they integrate? What was the situation then?
Well, you see, Vets is in the medical school. Oh. You can't be an instructor grade. It's not a school. That has to be in.
So any medical school student going to Emory is also working at Grady, is that it?
That's right. I don't remember the first year that Emory took a medical student. I do remember the first year that an intern, a black intern, came to Grady. But I don't remember the first year that a black medical student went to Emory School of Medicine as an undergraduate.
Did a black intern coming to Grady, was he bothered? Was he on the tough time?
Well, he felt a bit lonesome, of course, but there was no physical or verbal abuse that I'm aware of.
So
because it was obvious that this was going to be the whole principle of the situation had been demanded by the federal government and by by Martin Luther King and other people who wanted.
So the time had come, and the whites, for the most part, are now accepting it, maybe grudgingly, but they were accepting it.
That would be a reasonable description of it.
I was also curious about the training of black nurses. What was their situation in all this?
They were segregated for many years, and going way back, and this is from a bit of reading in the history of it, they were not allowed the RN, the registration, registered nurse. They were not given those initials. And then later on, they were given the registration, and then they were in two segregated schools of nursing. They had different colored uniforms, and they were called Nurse So-and-so, and the others, the whites, were called Miss So-and-so. The blacks were called Nurse So-and-so. And then they remained segregated like that until the mid-60s, and when here again, Martin Luther King, ATW, the marches forced the cancellation of the two schools that they had.
Do you have situations where they were harassed at all? Or situations in which white patients would refuse to be handled by a black nurse or a black doctor? Anything like that?
I don't know as I'm qualified to answer that. I just don't know. But you see, there would be little of that, or maybe asymptotic to zero of that, because throughout the days of slavery, the black female nurse and the white female or white male was a part of the scene. This was part of the culture, so that there would be no cause for that. But the black doctor was a different story. So that I would have doubted that there would be any problem with the black nurse nursing the white or male or female, except when you get some irate so-and-so who cantankerous no matter who nursed him or who nursed her, and he may have just used that to talk to the cantankerous.
That would be the case. I was curious also about any repercussions of the lack of training in segregated facilities at that time on health care for the black population in the city today. I mean, they had a segregated system up in the mid-60s. Do you see any remnants of that in terms of higher mortality rates today?
Well, I think the higher mortality rates are due to lifestyle more than physician. Now, of course, physicians help. But the difference now is a little more subtle. There is access for anybody of any color, but the access is more difficult for the black person. Therefore, he seeks it a little later. Therefore, he's sicker. And I'm using the word he, she, both genders. Therefore, he or she seeks it a little later than otherwise. For example, the low-income person who has to come to a public hospital arrives a little later with a given disease, let's say a breast tumor. Mm-hmm. And there have been studies to show this. A study was done by Dr. Gene Petrick. Dr. Petrick reviewed breast cancer at Grady Hospital and breast cancer at the private hospitals in Metro Atlanta and made a determination as to when the patient was first seen and examined, what was the state of advancement of the disease. It was found that the breast cancer in Grady patients, low-income people, black minority people, and white low-income people, but the black minority was the group she was studying, the Grady patients, which is about 75% black, plus or minus, came in some 4 to 6 times with advanced disease as the person going to a private hospital. Now, what did that include? It included education, it included funds for travel to the hospital, as small as that might be, it included a willingness to go, it included a longer wait at the low end, at the county hospital and at the private facility. Putting all that together, they arrived later. Their disease was in a more advanced stage, and the mortality rate was higher and the morbidity rate was higher. Now, given that same study in regard to cancer of the colon, the large intestine, the state of advancement of the disease between the Grady patient and the private patient was about the same. Why? One reason, and you never know all of the reasons, but an outstanding reason is that the colon with the tumor will tend to produce symptoms. So whenever anybody's uncomfortable, low income or high income, or a small amount of education, or a large amount of education, they seek help. So the difference was not so great in those ones. But now, given an educational campaign over a TV station, Fortune 500 magazine, Time magazine, whereby student examinations for adult blood are done, if everybody did it. What would happen there is that the black minority person with low education would probably be the last to take advantage of that, whereas the high income, black and white, with high education would hear about it because they read Time magazine, Fortune 500, look at channel this on TV, whereas this other fella is listening to a radio station that these higher educated people don't listen to it all. And if it doesn't come over that station, if he isn't educated and motivated to come in with a subtle test when there are no symptoms, then he's not going to know about it enough to do it, and therefore will wind up with a more advanced state of disease than the well-educated person
with a class situation.
That's right.
Would you say at all that I guess it's sort of a hard thing to determine also, that medical care improved for the indigent black patient once Grady was integrated into medical care?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt about that. It improves because people feel better. Acceptance of the individual as a first-rate human being took a definite step up. and let me add, I don't want you to get the idea that I'm discounting the number of black doctors available here. That's a factor too. But that's not the only factor having to do with higher mortality.
Oh, I agree
with that. Okay. Last one, but I just make that clear. Now, the medical care all over improved with recognition of nurses at school, first grade nurses, calling them this and giving them a feeding of dignity, recognition of patients as all first class human beings, dealing with them in that way, interns, residents being trained to treat everybody as a first class human being, the attendants, the medical staff, faculty, making rounds on everybody instead of in separate groups. All of that is there.
Plus black doctors getting better training.
Plus black doctors getting better training, plus black doctors being certified by specialty boards after adequate education. All of it fits into the common mold that produces a better doctor, a better society, a more healthy society, a longer living society, but more important than living long, living longer with a higher quality of life. That is really what I'm talking about.
No, I realize there's a lot of factors involved in this, but
right.
I can't help thinking, you know, again, given that racism at the time, that a lot of the white doctors just looked upon the black patient as just somebody not really concerned about the fact.
I wouldn't want to say that.
Or maybe it's too harsh to say.
Yeah, it really isn't, because, you see, they're human beings with feeling among whites and blacks. And there are doctors, white and black, a very, very few of them, who have mistreated patients, white and black. I've seen that. Mm-hmm. So that the big thing is that people are people. And that, and it's hard to say this, because if you say one sentence, somebody say, well, what about this? Well, that's true too. And it'll just take miles and miles of discussion here to try to make it all be as accurate as one would wish and want it to be. But there were white doctors who did have great concern for black patients and treated them just as well as white patients. But there were also white doctors who treated black patients as subhuman beings, not total human beings. And of course, the fact that many white doctors came up, grew up under a system whereby they were taught, or were by virtue of the way things people were treated, the blacks were less than the 100% human being. Therefore, their attitude was different. There were others who were afraid to let their friends see them treat a black person as a 100% human being, because they didn't want to lose the friendly relationship. For example, that would be whites, and just take a small example, who the word Negro was just as acceptable as the word black is now back then. When they were among black people, they would say Negro just as well as anybody. But when they would get in the presence of another white, they would split it. They would say nigger. And that lets the white person know that he was sympathetic towards segregation. And he didn't say nigger to insult the black. He just kind of split it like to try to satisfy both. And of course, you know, when you try to serve two masters, you don't really get any job.
Well, I just think that...
and that's a small example of what I'm trying to say to you.
Yeah, I just... Look, people brought up with that warped type of thinking about race,
sure.
had an effect.
Oh, sure.
On the parts of the
it affected what they did. And, well, that's
just the main mother.
I was curious also about something that Michael Womack had said a few days ago regarding this suggested renovation versus tearing down Grady and starting new. He said that the original design of the hospital was set up to serve a segregated system.
Yeah.
And that, in his words, that design has hampered an efficient modern operation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how has the previous segregated Grady Hospital, as it was built in 1958, hampered the operation of the hospital right now?
Well, most of that has been broken up. There are the mirror images of which was the original construction of the hospital. And what was done was to use those segregated, those separate facilities for different activities, which minimized the fact that it was physically built as a segregated building. For example, the emergency room that was for black patients is now used for medical emergency cases. The emergency room, which was for white patients, is now used for the emergency room for surgical patients. So that simply minimizes the difference. Now, suppose what we need now is an emergency room twice as wide as either one of them. So that's the cause for the renovation. The renovation, the building of the building as a segregated building did, no doubt, cause a greater expense, and it interferes somewhat now. But that was minimized by planning.
Or trying to do something with it.
By doing something with it. The main thing that's active now is the fact that medicine has changed and advanced. For example, when this hospital was constructed, nobody had heard of an intensive care. Nobody had done any open heart surgery. And now, what we have done is simply take various areas and renovate them and make an intensive care. Okay. Which is not as adequate as if it had been constructed for that company.
So what you're saying really is that what would have been the better, if there was no segregation back then, would have been one operating room that would have been sufficient.
Yes.
Was everything duplicated pretty much? Was it really
The wards were duplicated, the emergency clinics were duplicated, the elective clinics were duplicated, but the operating rooms were not.
So the same operating rooms used for black and white patients?
Yes.
At different times?
At different times. Now, one might be in one room and another one next to it. But they were both asleep and they wouldn't give a hoot when they were asleep. Because the main thing about a discussion like this is, for instance, if one were to pick a single sentence out of what I'm saying, they could say, white guy doesn't even know what time of day it is. But you have to take the total discussion and deal with it and not pick out any one.
Yeah, I'm just trying to give it a sense of...
Because if you take it out of context, it's not going to be what I'm trying to get over to you.
That's true of most things.
Yes, that's true.
Politicians...
That's very true.
But I guess then if the hospital had been built as a non-segregated hospital,
it would have been better.
It would have been better.
No
better problem. Better in terms of merging a lot of these separate rooms you were talking about, functioning better for the growing integrated population.
But it still would need renovation.
Oh yeah, I understand that.
Because it wasn't purely segregation, because at that time, to have a 8-bed ward was a big improvement, because when I was an intern and resident, we had 30-bed wards. And everybody's in this huge room with a little sheet between them, and we made ramps. So an 8-bed ward was a big improvement. We have 8 and 4-bed wards now. But just, I guess it wasn't a half an hour before you came here, daughter of a patient called and just blasted my ears because she wanted her mother in a private room, or no less than a semi-private room. Her mother was in a I believe she's in one of the eight bill forms. And she just doesn't want to know her name. And I can understand this. And that's why we, that's one of the main reasons we're, one of the main reasons we renovated the hospital, to abolish the eight bed and four bed units and to convert them all into two and one bed units, as well as to add laboratory facilities, larger emergency clinics, a larger operating room for open heart surgery, intensive care units, and
but it would have been more efficient back then to have had the whites and blacks together.
Oh yes, no doubt. It would have been more efficient by far. It would have been better bed utilization. Better bed utilization. See, because if one side was empty and the other side was running over, they couldn't transfer the patients to the racially opposite side, which is poor bed utilization.
That's not crazy, right?
Yes. That's where it was.
How about things like the emergency clinics? Was it the white one or the black one?
That is
right. I heard stories about blacks coming, this is really Charles Drew's story, really, too, about coming to a white emergency clinic and not being treated.
That didn't happen with Charles Drew. That's a myth.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know that. That's interesting.
That's a myth.
I heard that story for years.
No,
that he had not been treated at a white hospital.
No.
All right, well, in terms of Grady then, blacks coming to the white clinic, no matter how messed up they were.
No, blacks were refused treatment in white hospitals. That's why the myth persists.
Okay.
But Charlie Drew received the best care known at the time when he was injured in a hospital that was segregated in the beds. But the emergency room in that hospital was a common emergency room for whites and blacks. It was right out of Burlington, North Carolina.
Yeah,
I think I have some of that detail.
That's interesting.
When you get a chance to look at it.
But in terms of Grady, though, they were separate.
They were separate.
And that was, I guess, an expensive duplication also.
And one
that harmed patients, I suppose, too.
Yes, yes.
How about the double ambulance service?
I just don't know a thing about how to...
Okay, let me just tell you, I heard stories about...
I'm not aware of how they work there.
Somebody calling in saying they were in an automobile accident, they're injured, and the first question would be white or black, and if it was white, of course, the ambulance would come out, and if it was a black fellow lying there, hurt, had to wait around until the black ambulance was ready, even though the white ambulance was ready.
I have heard that and know that that did exist. No question about that. So how Grady worked that, I just...
Well, they worked it that way.
They did work it the same way, I see.
And that had to impinge...
Good night. Have a pleasant weekend.
That had to impinge on a fairly black health care.
Oh, no question about it.
That's
because the time of care was important.
How well,
especially in trauma, because a few minutes here or there would and make the difference between saving a patient's life and death.
Yeah, that certainly could have contributed.
And I have heard tales of that occurring. I just frankly don't have any personal experience with it, whereas on the wards and the emergency clinics, I had abundant personal experience with it. But I have heard of it, and I believe it.
That itself would increase black mortality.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But that's not where the big
one is. I understand that.
It would be a factor.
How well was Spaulding funded?
Spaulding was funded insufficiently for continued growth and development. As time went along, the initial building was well constructed, but Spaulding was not funded as medicine grew, changed to keep abreast of the development.
Not as well funded as the white hospital. That's crazy.
Okay.
I want you to say it. I mean, I know.
Yeah. It did not keep abreast of what was going on.
thing. And that, too, had a factor in it.
Yes.
But
still, that's not the truth.
I understand. There's all these little things.
Yes, it's part of it. But, and Spalding was built, it's designed, as I understand it, as an H-shape, but the rest of it was never built. The one limb in the short was constructed, and the rest of it was never completed, so the Spalding was not funded in order to keep it fresh. Medicine was not expanded. Its intensive care unit followed others. They do have one, a little bit later than some of the others. The wards were renovated from 4 beds down to 2 and 1 bed wards, so that they don't have the big wards like we have over here at Grady. But the modern instrumentation, such as CT scans and so on, are not there. And there are many reasons for that. The patient demand fell off as people moved out of town. The white doctors left, as the black doctors left after that. Such that the whole Spalding clientele fell down. There are not enough black doctors in town. We need no black doctors of any description, any specialty you can think of. And if there were more, hospitals like Spalding, like Southwest Community, like physicians and surgeons on Bolton Road, would have a much larger patient flow. But with the small number of doctors, and this is something you don't hear much, well, there aren't enough doctors to bring in enough patients to keep either one of them going well.
Spalding still runs as a private
hospital. Now, they don't have the 12 indigent beds that we had, that we talked about earlier, anymore. Those beds were there from about 1958 through about 1970s.
So, okay.
It could have been 69.
So,
right through there, that those 12 beds were removed from Spalding. At the time when there were white and black doctors working over there, they had an abundant number of patients. Now, at that time, they had very good equipment at the outset, and the building was well constructed. Matter of fact, it's been one of the better constructed hospitals in town, abundant marble and all this kind of thing. And the instruments were of high quality and very good
initially.
Then, as time wore on, when integration occurred, and a large number of white doctors took their black patients to white hospitals in their communities, by then the income at Spalding was reduced. The authority pumped money into Spalding to air-condition additional segments of it, to reduce the rooms from 4 beds to 2 beds into private rooms. But the clientele, the patient influx, did not improve with those things. So that as additional funds were placed there was no increase, there was no response by an increase in patients. The air conditioning didn't do it. The renovation producing 2-bed and 1-bed units, private and sanitized, didn't do it. The addition of this access center and emergency clinic didn't do it. And the only thing that I see that would bring an increased number of patients into Spalding, if you're talking about private only, would be a pronounced interest started Morehouse School of Medicine to use that as a teaching hospital, and that is academic faculty house its patients that can treat. Otherwise, the patients aren't coming because we need more black doctors. The patients will be going to other hospitals nearer their homes, like most black people of means with good insurance and so on, simply moved out from the central part of the city, just as did it, like to the periphery of the city and into the suburban.
During the time that, Grady was, that other hospitals, private hospitals in the city were segregated across the lawn from everyone, during that 58 to about 65 period was Golden being funded very well. During that time, it was strictly a black hospital at the beginning of the funding. And the blacks had no place like that.
Well, you see, when you say being funded, you ask a question that's not accurate. Spalding was not supposed to be funded. Spalding was supposed to make money off of private patients to develop itself. Spalding was not a county hospital.
They got no money to
fund it. They got it because it went into debt. And it had to have it in order to survive. Spalding would have closed many years ago if the authority hadn't pumped money.
Does Emory at all?
So that it's a false question to ask if Spalding was funded. That was not the intent of Spalding. Spalding was supposed to be a private union for the care of black patients by black doctors. And then grafted on that was for the accredited education of black doctors and specialty training.
Did Emory have anything to do with funding the hospitals at all?
No, not at all.
Did the
they did make a donation in terms of to get the hospital started.
So really it's self-supporting.
It's supposed to be self-supporting, but it hasn't been in a number of years.
The black areas, black sections of Greenville, were they funded any less well, equipped less well than the white sections of Greenville?
You see, there would be no point in that, because the white doctor trained predominantly on the black patient. So to put less there would be cutting off his own nose.
So I think this is a great part of everything.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
and of course, as I told you, the operating rooms were common.
Right.
And I believe the x-ray area was the problem. I'm not 100% certain.
Labs were coming?
Not the ward lab, no. Because that was on the ward, which was segregated. But the central lab was coming. I believe that.
The other thing I wanted to turn to, getting away from medicine, was your stint on the Board of Education back in 1967 to 1977, and I was been doing some work on the Board of Education, dealing with segregation in the city.
Sure. Now you have a number of individuals who were educated there, and you saw that in that first chapter.
Right.
A number that have been certified, and of course, mind you, that those numbers aren't pure; they're mixed because the two institutions, the Tuskegee Veterans Hospital and Spalding, work cooperating.
Right, I saw that. Yeah, about that. And actually, I had spoken to Grace Hamilton about before she had got the city family.
Right.
I just spoke to John Kaplan. I hadn't realized his relationship to Tuskegee at all. That man has done more than I've seen anybody ever do in a lifetime. He's been in so many different places.
Yeah.
Interesting for him.
Yeah, Calvin, by far, he and I were classmates. And Morehouse.
Really?
He wasn't the youngest person in the planet, but he was in the class. I was not acutely aware of who he was and the fact that he had been at Tuskegee. I knew him, of course, by virtue of the fact that he and I were classmates. We had classes together at Morehouse. But, because when I was at Morehouse, very little knowledge of these things going on in 1922 in Tuskegee. I doubt if I was reading the newspapers at that time, as Calvin was a grown man. But as I got some knowledge of it, naturally I went back and talked to him about it and read a bit. Have you talked with him?
Oh, yeah.
You know, well, I'm glad you did, because he's an
Board of Education. I was curious of your feelings about John Letson's handling of the segregation. Mm-hmm. Do you think he moved too slowly?
Well, he did not get the job done that we, the board, felt should be done. We supported the concept that if the administration were completely integrated, qualitatively and quantitatively, and if there was a black superintendent, and if the teachers were completely integrated, qualitatively and quantitatively, then that could be no racial discrimination as far as education is concerned in the school system. Now that's the principle on which we the board
operate. We supported generally the compromise and segregated by the
board. Well, I don't regard it as a compromise. I regard it as a truism of the thing that I just said to you. That if there is no racial segregation or discrimination, even better, in administration, teachers, then this would eliminate the racial discrimination in the school system. But that would be the control of teachers, principals, administration, physical plant, teaching materials, books, libraries, everything.
In fact, I spoke to Ron McCain,
so that I feel very strongly that that was a wholesome thing to do, or else he wouldn't have done it.
And the problem there, from others I've spoken to, Letson dragged his feet for so long, he allowed the whites to flee the city. By the time the blacks gained control of the administration, the white population came to
the line. I'm afraid that Letson couldn't let or prevent the whites from fleeing the city. I think he was going. Now, if he had done it sooner, there would have been more there, but they would have left sooner.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
And he couldn't have kept them in. I don't think Letson could keep those people in that school system with busing at all.
Well,
I don't think I could have done it. I don't think you could have done it.
There are cities that were more successful. In Atlanta, there is one of the 10 most segregated cities in the country today.
Yes, but what did they do? Charlotte Mecklenburg. They expanded it. Now that's a different thing.
Okay, well, of course, Kathy Bushing, that would have been
fine. Now you see, that's a different thing. Now, if we had gone for unifying all of the school system in Fulton and DeKalb counties, then that could have been accomplished with busing and with a racial balance in the school. But that was not the issue.
What do you think about the freedom of choice plan?
I think the freedom of choice plan is one of the methods that we... Now, if you're talking about M&M, that's what I'm thinking about. Are you thinking of that?
This is actually before M&M.
You're talking about freedom of choice only? Then no, that's out.
Okay. The feeling I've gotten again is what freedom of choice did was to make it tough for blacks to get into white schools, white majority schools, because I had to pass all sorts of tests, I had to be in proximity, I had to be...
Freedom of choice was not it.
And it allowed a lot of the whites to escape. Their freedom of choice meant go running away.
Well, they were going to escape anyway.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's true.
Don't you think for one minute they wanted to escape? Now, freedom of choice simply was not acceptable and was not workable.
But it was the one push for a long time. That was Lexington's main partner.
Well, that's That was not the Board of Education.
Okay.
After we got
out. I want to
hear that. Was before we.
I'm trying to get your feelings about Alexis having a desegregation. Whether you think he was an impediment to it, or did he actually try to honestly develop a desegregation? Please listen to him.
That's a responsibility of the Board. We were the ones who did that. Letson could help, or Letson could make suggestions and recommendations, but it was the responsibility of the Atlanta Board of Education to integrate those school systems.
That school system. Before you were only the third Black on the board.
Yeah, that's right.
And, Lucas Clement was there for a long time, but, you know, everything I gathered is that he didn't put as much of a fight about what Letson was doing.
Well, you see, there's no doubt in my mind that Lucas Clement believed in, Dr. Clement believed in school integration as much as anybody. But when you have one vote against whatever the others were, sure, then there you are. And that was the way it was for a brief while I was on the board, only two of us for a while, a few months, and there were three for
years.
Ours take. But we got a lot done. Even though we were in a very distinct minority, just by being.
Oh, yeah.
That helps. And then there were some other things that we got done, too. Because it took the lawsuit to actually break up the rigid segregation that existed. Plus the fact that we felt that once we got a good balance throughout the system, racial balance, that part of the education could be placed out of the schools.
But the racial balance never included.
Oh, yes, in the administration.
Oh,
it
did?
Okay. And in the teachers.
One other thing I've heard is that...
But not with the students, because the others left. And they left in droves. And I don't think... Now, I'm not saying at all, and I don't want you to get the wrong impression. The lesson was a energetic integration.
I didn't think that.
No. But he could not have prevented white flag. I don't care who he did.
I'm not saying he could
have... No, he could have... If, let's just say he had the ability, which he didn't. Now, the bully control lesson, you have to know that. And he had a predominantly, by far, white bully. Now, what Letson would have done if he had been King Letson, I don't know. I suspect it probably would have been too different. But, and that's pure speculation, I don't know the truth of that. But, it must be said that the Boyd is the one who should be faulted, not less.
To a certain extent, yes.
Yeah. Now, there were those who felt like Letson was brought there to maintain and keep segregation. And there were those who accused him of it. I never heard him say that.
I thought he would have said it.
No, I never heard him say it. But there were segregations who did. Herman Talmadge, Eugene Talmadge, Russell down here, for whom a federal building is named, and that's a mistake. Keep that building, should not be named after Russell.
Same mistake having Tom Watson statue.
That's right. Tom Watson statue. Ought to go. Except in one thing. It's history.
Yeah, but it's
history.
That type of history should be.
I would put Martin Luther King statue there. Maybe 100 times big, and maybe let it stay there. That's all right. Tom Watson didn't contribute anything that worthy of his having a statue.
I agree. Except for consider hating.
Yes, he was a hate monger. Everything kind of
One more thing I want to point out is there was a school that was.
I'm trying to develop some words. Give a bit of fair praise of your question. He preached to us that he was trying to desegregate the schools, when I say us, I mean the board, in a way as not to run the whites out of the system and yet comply with the law. That's the preaching he did to us. Now, what he felt in his heart and mind, I don't have any way of knowing. And he, of course, attempted to maintain the status quo to a great extent and comply with the law. And I guess he was trying to do both.
Well, he said, I spoke with him too, and he said he felt he was being pushed to move too fast. He had gone slower than they had ever been about us.
Well, many Southerners felt going slower. I don't think that is true. I think that what you have to have is the law to make people move, and the people to make people move to comply with the law. Let them believe that.
There's also a lawyer on the board that he worked with.
Letson never refused. He never stood in the door like Robert.
Okay.
No, he never did that. He would move when the law said you had to do this. And when the board attorney, Larry, said that that's what the law says. He was the interpreter of the law. I'm trying to recall if Letson ever took a step for integration that he didn't have to take.
Good point.
And I'm not sure that he did. I remember when I made the motion to put the big general fund in a black bank system, trust bank. He tried to deter me from doing that by saying, you mean this other fund, don't you, which is a smaller thing, that you've been willing to compromise to put in system. So I told him, no, I'm talking about the general fund. And we got that full on vote.
The whites on the board supported it?
Yes. On rotation. And Citizens Trust was brought into handling the fund for a period of time. And there was another thing that the holidays. I made the motion to bring in Memorial Day as a holiday. We're not able to get that through as such at that time on the first try. This was before Dr. Mays. And he was able to sway the board to bring it in as a day on which we would teach the purpose of Memorial Day, but not have it as a holiday. It was similar to a day for Robert E. Lee or individuals at that level, wherein the students would on that day say, Lee was born at this time, Memorial Day is today, and its purpose is this and this thing. In other words, they receive education, but not.
What was his resistance based on?
Again,
Memorial Day. Did you see that in racial terms at all?
Well, it was, of course it was. You know, there were two Memorial Days.
Well, I know.
Southern and the so-called National or North. And it was Northern according to Southern.
Right, right.
But it was a National Memorial Day.
That's
of course it was racial. I have no question about it. So then we finally got that broken and got it through as a holiday itself.
He didn't, my impression of all is that he did what the courts requested to, as you said.
Made him do.
But he was resistant.
And he didn't stand in the door, but he didn't make voluntary extra efforts to go beyond what the court required to desegregate, integrate the school system. I think that's perhaps accurate for a short statement. If I were to sit down tonight and draft something, I could do better.
Well,
a short, off the cuff, off the top of my head statement, that probably portrays
I think when Dr. Crittenden was in, he was sure of what things could have been done in magnet schools, for example, efforts to create non-racial geographical school codes. All these things could have, I think, prevented some work.
Well, those things were all discussed, and mind you, it takes a certain amount of time to get the idea from school and so forth. They were discussed as well, as we were developing the so-called Atlantic
Ecology. The other thing, Mr. Blessing, I wanted to deal with, I heard that when the teaching staff were integrated, that the style was to send the best black teachers into the white schools.
Yes, I do recall that, and I suspect there was merit to that, actually. I suspect there was merit to that, because but I do remember now, it's coming back to me, that was done on the basis of lottery.
Mm-hmm. There wasn't a case of the best.
There may have been some of this subtle, but there was a huge amount of that done on the basis of lottery. Now, maybe a few might have been placed other than the lottery, mm-hmm. but that was done on the basis of a lottery.
I'm just curious.
And I'm trying to think now how that lottery was carried out.
I think I do remember reading about a lottery.
Yes, there was a lottery.
I guess I was trying to think how many of the best white teachers were put in the majority of black schools, and I doubt that happened.
That had to be a part of the lottery as well. I'm trying to think whether we called for volunteers at the outset.
You might have.
And we need them.
I think if anybody was really resistant, they were allowed to step out of the lottery.
I suspect some of that did occur, but the greater part of it was done by mine. You know, they're always subtle. I can't be too certain about that. I suspect some of that would occur, but it was cheaper.
Well, that's the end of it, I guess.
Well, let's see if there's anything you want to know about that. We didn't catch up. We certainly haven't tried it all. No way. Do it in one session, okay. Because I'll think of something this evening that
if you think of something, I'll be glad to come back and talk to you again. Or put it into a letter, and that certainly would be helpful too.
I can remember it. The Fulton County Medical Center, and they were forced to accept people. Another thing I remember is, it's when Martin Luther King himself called and asked if I would examine him in the hospital. And there was one other black full-time person called in addition to myself. And, of course, I mentioned to him that I'm Martin Luther King, I just come over next day. And I have this examination card at home, and I can read it. I'm very proud of it. And I said, well, you're working on a segregated institution in the town. So I guess he's going to march all over us. So he came. He was the nicest person, the easiest person to get by. He had ever been seen there. And he didn't mention one time whether he worked on a segregated institution or not. And I examined him maybe two or three times. And we felt perfectly at home, and he just understood even better than you did. We were in the segregated institution. And St. Joseph's was opening up a two-room at Spalding, an outpatient, educating its own Jewish nurses and so on. Then he was very fatigued after some of the big pushes. Now, hospitalized him in St. Joseph's Hospital when that was up from there in the United States. They gave him some medication, fellow insurance, at that time, St. Joseph was the only wife for the hospital that would accept his wife on an integrated basis, and they had just changed, they wouldn't do it. he stayed a few days. In a book by
David Garrow.
He talks about it.
Yeah. Did he speak to you at all?
Say what?
Did he speak to you?
No. I didn't know anything about it. A friend of mine told me that it was him. And he is down out of
there. Yeah, he's down out of
there. Along that line, I recall W. Montague Carr, who was professor of anatomy and anthropology, MD, PhD. And he was president of the National Medical Association, which is a national organization. Took a group of us to the White House, and we did President King to explain to him the need for integrating the schools. The hospitals throughout the nation. And I'll never forget my surprise. President Kennedy said that he didn't know that the Catholic hospitals refused to take black people based on race, and that they were segregated sometimes as well as black law. And that he was just not aware of that.
That's interesting.
And he, of course, was grateful that we had visited with him, and surprised him, in fact, that in the South, Southeast, even the religious hospitals, all of them, Catholic, Baptist, what have you, were refusing black patients over segregated and usually in the way. And that's the thing that causes the myth about Charlie Drew to persist. Charlie Drew was a native tribute given everything, blood, goods, given his injuries to the world. He had a, what do you call it, computer tube or something that across the chest. Carl Rose wrote on top of the chest. Face and neck was swollen. He didn't live it. In that short period of time, but could not be tuned. Unfortunately, he threw his heart. Muscles were sheared off of it. Fractures. But anyway, Charlie Lee was getting full treatment. The black doctors in the area went there immediately, and every one of them took him in and said he was getting very cooperative treatment by the white doctors here in the hospital. Matter of fact, there were four doctors in the car, all of them.
Oh, right.
And, yes, and only Charlie Lee was unconscious. The other two of them see on the mound, and four. Including Charlie Drew, received on the fractures of his collarbone. One of his shoes off his feet. But anyway, they helped resuscitate Charlie Drew before even an ambulance, because they were right there and got him to breathing. And they said that the people there were just as cooperative.
Were they aware of how important the person was? The white doctors at the time?
They seemed to be used to call me. Sam Bullock, who owned the car that Charlie Drew was driving, said that they did everything he and Sam Bullock were safe several times. But the fact that black people were looking is now I think about it, you mentioned. See, I never rode an ambulance. I was in the US, I don't remember. 35 years ago, what happened? But now that you mention it, it comes back to me. They worried. And I can remember better now than I could remember the first time. Oh, yeah. They were refused. But those refusals support them there because those things did occur to the people, to all of them. So anything that is truthful as that, any one myth is going to persist, and we just can't get rid of it. The Time magazine published this. If they didn't give Drew blood, they refused to give him blood. That's a busted charge. Anyway, and I wrote them, telling them that this was not true. Many people have written articles in journalism that was not true. Johnson, who was in the car, position of his name on the call to be a nearby person, he wrote his name, but you can't get rid of him. And I wrote Time magazine, and told them the facts and the truth. They never issued it to them.
Yeah. Well, I guess
they didn't want to admit that Time magazine could write something that wasn't
true.
And since they knew I was not a rap native to make them do it, they didn't do it.
Well, I guess Dr. Drew is a symbol of ambulance service for blacks, I guess. In that sense, it was true.
So I did get a chance to put it in my chapter in the book. So I
had
it.
Well, if you think of anything, you know, give me
things that I did, you know, I remember with ease that, okay, when I was chief of surgery at Dusty Gabriel's Hospital, and I met him yesterday, there was a black patient shot in the head just a few miles north of Atlanta. Just a little bit. And he was, see, the Tuskegee VA Hospital was the black veteran for the centerpiece. He was transported past the Veterans Hospital in Atlanta, and I think that was the wartime temporary hospital.
That was white.
What?
It was a white hospital.
Yes. But do you remember the name of that hospital? I know it was the name of it. To us in Tuskegee, I'm a general surgeon, and somebody had shot me in the dead center, and that bullet was against the posterior, the back of his skull, the traveler's skull, And I looked at these things and said, darn shame to send this man down to deal with Lawson General Hospital. That's the name. The Lawson General Hospital, just a few miles away, to us, me without neurosurgery. And I said, he cannot be. People were doing it, tend to be, so we transported him back. So he didn't
survive. Would he survive? Had he gotten back to treatment with him?
Most gunshot injuries. I can't say he would, because they all went down.
Which certainly didn't help him.
But it sure most certainly did not help him. With all that delay, and that time was probably about a 3.5 hour trip with those highways now. But he was, to me, that was the most blatant instance of refusal to care for a black patient in a white hospital.
That's pretty close to that. You can't get a worse wound than that, I suppose.
Now, whether they had a segregated black ward at Lawson General, I think it was here. I do remember visiting it once. But I do know they transported it. And we actually destroyed it with the layout. And I got it out. Also, I've known of white appearing black people that I know socially right here in Atlanta who were brought to white hospitals by ambulances thinking they were white and treated. And of course, some rejected and would leave.
Really, it's comical to them, so tragic.
Oh, you don't know that.
That's very interesting. Well, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you.